Johnson with Kristen Bride. Now, yesterday when Greg Bach was here, he kept teasing me about, you know, subtly dropping all the places I've lived and when I was living in San Francisco or New York or whatever. And I know he was joking, but it got me thinking as in preparation for today is that because I've gotten to live in a lot of different places, I have a lot of very interesting friends who've grown into having very accomplished, impressive careers. So I was like, I should start getting more of these people on the show. And today is no different. And I'm so excited to have both of these women who I've known for over 10 years, which is wild. I met both of you separately in different cities in 2011. And look at us now. And so for the rest of the hour, basically, we're going to be talking about health tech, and specifically health tech when it comes to women, both in the companies that are trying to solve problems that women have, but also what it's like to work in health tech and what it's like to work in health tech as a mother. So our guests are Alyssa Jaffe, who is a partner at Seven Wire Ventures, where she invests in companies that empower people to be better stewards of their health, and Christina Farr, who is a former journalist, author of the Substack Second Opinion, and a health tech investor at Omers Ventures. Welcome, ladies.
Thanks for having us. So good to be here.
Good to see you.
So it was so funny because I'm assuming you two ended up meeting, because I know you from two different worlds. One of Alyssa and I met when I spent my last semester in DC, and Christina and I met at a party in San Francisco, both in 2011. But then did you both meet because of your work in this sphere?
We met because Chrissy was a reporter for CNBC. Chrissy created the digital health beat there, and she was trying to get info from me. And no, she was awesome. We had an interview while I was a VC. I'm pretty sure I was like 7 months pregnant.
I was just going to say, you were super pregnant. I think it was number two, right?
Yes. And I just had my third, and we instantly hit it off. We became super close friends. Fast forward, Chrissy transitioned to the dark side here and came to be a VC. And now we're co-invested together in a number of companies. So it's a crazy world, and it's only getting smaller.
Yes, that is. We're in Chicago, San Francisco, and Milwaukee, the next big hub for tech, maybe. So my idea to have both of you on came from Chrissy. I think this was maybe a month or so ago. You tweeted out, the people who say the fertility space has a small TAM, so total addressable market, are the same people who would have argued that the TAM for Airbnb is essentially the luxe travel market. Demand is far, far outstripping supply right now. So if anyone can bring the price down, the market majorly opens up. And I thought that was super interesting because it was one of those, I forgot what the phenomenon's called, but where you see it for the first time and then you start seeing it everywhere. Because then I felt like I started seeing other ideas of the baby formula shortage and what that's opening up, and different things as far as women's reproductive health or being a mom, and how technology or these companies can solve these problems and make it not only come up with solutions, but also make solutions cheaper. And so for both of you, what are some of the companies or ideas that you're excited about that specifically would help women?
Well, I'll touch on this first because that tweet hilariously was actually responded to by Elon Musk.
I know.
Which the only time in my social media career that has happened. I think it's because he's very invested in the space, having had about 19 children himself. So that was just really funny that day, and it caused that tweet to go somewhat viral. Yeah, I mean, I think this all comes down to the idea that really anything that Alyssa and I look at and invest in women's health, I mean, in theory, there's so many reasons why it makes sense. Like, we're talking about 50% of the population, women make 80% of the buying decisions in healthcare. We are the chief health officers of our household. And yet over and over and over again, you hear that these businesses have small markets that they're addressing, and the word that I hear all the time still is these are niche products and services. And this just blows my mind that you could think that anything targeting women is niche. So I think that's one of the things that I was sort of trying to address in that tweet, is that these opportunities are so big. And then you look at something like the fertility area, where one in eight couples struggle to conceive. Mm-hmm. And just, again, it's like, how could you think that that's a small opportunity? It's when a couple can't conceive, they'd do anything. They would move mountains to be able to have a child and birth a family. So that's kind of been our mission in life as investors, is to kind of re-educate the men in our space who represent the vast majority of venture capital to start seeing this as a real business opportunity, and not a niche, and not just a philanthropic kind of side hustle.
Alyssa, do you have thoughts on that? Or I guess even the companies that you gals are investing in, as far as big ideas that you think could be wildly successful if they get off the ground?
Yeah. So, Chrissy made some great points about, as you think about the power of purchasing for women, but also the challenges that we go through as it relates to our healthcare journey. And she and I both have spent a lot of time in thinking through where there's material opportunity. And quite frankly, it creates for us the ability. So at 7Wire, we have an operator-driven model. So we're really involved with our companies. We do fewer deals, we're more concentrated so that we can help drive growth. And as part of this strategy, we can be more creative. So we invest in companies, but we also start companies through something we call Hatch, in which we can build companies where we see opportunity. And one of the examples here is, we spend a lot of time in women's health, and Chrissy mentioned some of the large items in claims, whether it be fertility, maternal care. We're starting to see some postpartum companies, menopause. But as we kept going back to this thesis around, like, what is it for a woman and her journey in healthcare? One of the things that kept sticking with us was, well, where are the inflection points? And most women enter the U.S. healthcare system in their early teens. They need access to birth control. A parent makes them an OBGYN appointment. But then they turn 18 and they leave home and they effectively fall off the face of the earth. Like, the system doesn't engage with them. They don't engage with the system. But meanwhile, so many things are happening as it relates to their health. It's really important, whether it be the conditions that may affect their fertility later on in life, like PCOS or endometriosis, or anxiety and depression. Women are disproportionately affected than men. And there's all these things building up. And instead of supporting them, we basically leave them to fend for themselves. And a lot of them end up on college campuses where they're going to a place that says, we're here for your education, for your safety, for your food, for your housing, but somehow we're not here for your health. That's not our responsibility. And instead, you're going to get this little card with a number on the back that says, call your insurance if you need anything. And 96% of college students 93% of college students have some kind of health insurance. 76% of them are dependent on their parents' plan. So they're paying into the system and they're not getting any benefit. And we finally said enough is enough, that if we really want to think about longitudinal care, if we really want to think about preventative and proactive care, that we have to start earlier. We have to start at that major inflection point as women are leaving home and going to a university and they're on a college campus. And so we decided to look around to see if anybody was really solving this problem, and felt like nobody was solving it in this comprehensive way. And whether it be for primary and urgent care, for women's health, for mental health, sexual health, pharmacy, crisis. And we said, we'll do it. Let's roll up our sleeves and build this business. So we launched an idea that took a very long time. Chrissy was one of the first confidants that I went to be like, am I crazy? Is this something we should build? And so grateful that she ended up coming in with us, and we actually co-invested in a business today called Caraway, and it's real and it's launched, and it's focused on driving agency and independence in a woman's healthcare journey starting on college campuses. We recruited an amazing CEO, Lori Evans Bernstein. She had exited a business, very successful healthcare operator, and we're off to the races. It's early, so a lot to be done. But for us, ultimately, was how can we do this to be successful?
Well, I didn't even know that was a thing. That's so exciting. And I agree. As you said that, I was trying to think of, what did I do for health care or health insurance when I was in college. And I can't even remember. Our guests this half hour are Alyssa Jaffe and Christina Farr, who both are venture capitalists in the health tech world. And we only have 3 minutes before we have to go to our first break, so we can keep the conversation going if this is too much of a big question. But as you, whether it's Caraway Health or some of the other companies that you're ever developing or investing in, because sometimes these growing companies, as we've seen, Airbnb potentially being part of our housing crisis, and sometimes the exploitation of some of the drive shares of being exploiting workers and stuff. And so with something as sensitive as our health, how do you look at companies and see the problem that they're solving, but also look out for the ways that they could potentially make things, the negative externalities, not necessarily make things worse, but as far as how they could get exploited because a company needs to make money?
This is like the most important question I could have asked, and I do not have an answer in 2 minutes.
Okay. We could come back and talk about it after the break too, but I didn't even know that I was going to ask that question, but as you were talking about it, I was like, that feels important.
It's a huge question. And we think about it. I think about it so much. And Alyssa and I have talked about it a great deal. When you are in venture capital, you're looking for businesses that will achieve a certain amount of scale, and you're looking for a certain amount of returns. And sometimes that doesn't make sense with the healthcare context. So you have to find the right types of businesses that can scale in that way, that can satisfy a venture investor. And that may be kind of limited in scope. And I think we're all trying to figure out what that looks like. But we've seen lots of examples in the press of, you know, things blowing up because there aren't the right quality controls, that the physicians are feeling pressured to take care of patients in a way that doesn't feel kind of ethically aligned for them. And that technology can sometimes be a catalyst for all of this. That said, Kristen, I think the current system as is also super broken.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't fall into the trap of saying that anything innovative is necessarily bad and that we don't want our healthcare disrupted, because the current system needs some changes.
Absolutely. So let's go to keep that thought. We'll go to break and we'll answer the rest of it as soon as we come back. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
The rhyme, it is wicked. Those that don't know how to be pros get evicted. A woman could bear you, break you, take you. Now it's time to rhyme. Can you relate to a sister dope enough to make?
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. Our guest this half hour is Alyssa Jaffe and Christina Farr, who both work in venture capital for health tech companies. And before the break, I had asked a big monstrous question as far as how do you invest and develop healthcare companies, knowing that they need to be able to scale and be profitable, but also will not exploit people. And Alyssa, I mean, Christina had a great answer. And Alyssa, I don't know if you want to also touch on that.
Yeah, maybe I'll just cap it off here that, look, we're not CPG and we're not building widgets over here. Yeah. Like, this is real people's lives. And so companies that get into hot water are ones that market in the way that sometimes consumer brands are marketed. And this is people's lives and it's people's health and it's the outcomes that they drive. And one of the ways that we also solve for this is we think a lot about founder market fit. We not just, you know, we talk a lot about product market fit in this industry, but founder market fit is the person or the team there to solve the problem? Do they genuinely understand this problem more deeply than almost anybody else? Why are they the best people in order to do that? I mean, they really connect with the problem. We've had founders who have severe mental illness. We've had founders who've had behavioral health businesses for their kids and building pediatric mental health support, whatever it may be. They get it, they understand it, and they're servicing the population while also servicing the challenge that they had experienced themselves.
And that's such a good point, because I know since the pandemic, the amount of ads I now, as someone who is ADHD, the amount of ads I get now for different ADHD medicine or apps or all of these things that sound really enticing to be able to, maybe this will help. But you're right, as far as these health apps being direct to consumer marketing strategy that you don't necessarily have to consult with your doctor, your primary care physician, to get access to, whether it's a drug or a, you know, paid for BetterHelp therapist and stuff like that. So it's interesting is thinking about who's providing the information or the service or the, I guess, drug, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So to pivot a little bit, just because you both are working moms and you work in high pressure, male dominated industries, how's that going?
Maybe I'll start. So this is Melissa. I'm a mom of three boys, and you know, I think I actually recently wrote an article for Fortune. Stop asking women about work-life balance. It doesn't actually exist. And I think a lot of what we do in this world is people try to ask us to solve that there's a silver bullet, and in reality, it's every day. We're thinking about our families, our careers, our kids, our spouses, our friends, our family. And it's balance. It's unbalanced. Like the act of balancing is, think about a seesaw. Like you keep going back and forth until you inevitably are trying to hit an equilibrium that you almost never hit. And there's wonderful people in this industry and there's not so wonderful people in this industry. And I think many of us know that. But one of the things that we also have the benefit of is we have lived experiences. We have a diverse perspective. I've given birth to three kids. I know what that experience feels like. And so when there's a maternal health company that comes and talks about now, and my experience is privileged. My experience is unlike most women in this country. And at the same time, it's just being able to connect and have empathy and be a listener for the things that we understand that not everybody does. So ultimately, Chrissy and I talk a lot about this. We're on a text chain with a bunch of a small group of VC women that we're all very close. And it's so wonderful to have a group of women that you can talk to about anything, that we can have one part of the text is about the current markets and what's going on in digital health funding. The next part of the text is about, how to manage a child that's being really difficult. And the next is like, my baby was up last night. And we just continue to have that cyclicality in a way that feels like a whole person. It feels like we don't have to bifurcate ourselves in different buckets and that we can be ourselves.
Yeah, I think everything Alyssa said resonates so much. And, just to kind of level set for those viewers that may not kind of watch the venture capital industry quite so closely, but most funds have no women. Mm-hmm. And if they do, it's one check writer. So, that's the current state of things. And it's been like this for a really long time. It's a very, very male dominated industry. And so if you come in and you're the kind of one solo female check writer, I think you have some unique challenges, but also some unique opportunities. And like Alyssa said, sometimes your male colleagues may not see certain opportunities that are obvious mm-hmm. to us as women. And so I like to think that, their bias can be our benefit.
Well, and instinctually that makes so much sense, right? Is if you're trying to look out for things as far as what you would be looking for as a woman, as a mom, and having the people who have never and will never go through that be the ones being like, well, I think this is a good company or a bad company because of X, Y, Z. And that doesn't speak because they're not the target market of who they would be talking to anyways. Right. So it always baffles me when like makeup companies and underwear companies and all of these heavily like targeted industries that focus on selling things to women are headed up and started by men and invested by men.
Yes. Like part of our job too. I mean, part of our job as investors is to see things other people can't see, but also to, I don't have a severe mental illness, but I have to understand what that's like and can invest in a company there. At the same time, to Chrissy's first point of women make 80% of healthcare decisions. And as being the primary healthcare purchaser, we do know we have done this for our family. And ultimately, our job is to change it from the inside. Our job is to recruit amazing, diverse people to be on our teams and train those people to be the next generation of check writers. We are about to kick off a search for somebody on our team, and that's super important. Like, we need to have different perspectives around the table because that's what makes our firm. amazing. That's what makes us have a competitive advantage in the types of checks that we write.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Alyssa, I know we have to let you go, but Christina's going to stick around. Thank you so much, Alyssa Jaffe, for joining us. We will definitely put your article up on the website so people can go read that. But thank you so much. And so stick with us. Christina Farr will still be here when we get back. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Mother, who's the root of it, and next up is me, the M-O-N-I-E-L-O-V-E, and I'm first, cause I'm a L-A-Z-I-E. Contact, and in fact, the style, it gets harder, cooling on the scene with my European partner, laying down track after track, waiting for the climax, when I get there, that's when I tax the next man, or the next woman, it doesn't make a difference, keep the competition coming, and I recite chapter and verse, the title of this recital is Ladies First.
To As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. Christina Farr is still here, who works in venture capital. We're investing in health tech. And it's interesting because you were like one of the most prominent health tech journalists for a long time. And you left CNBC to leave journalism entirely and go to be a VC. And so I want to get back to the mom question, but even making such a big career jump, did it feel like a big career jump, or did it feel kind of like a natural progression?
Yeah, it's actually linked to the mom question, because I got my new job in venture when I was, I think, 8 months pregnant, which is like not something I would advise for anyone to do, a massive career transition, like mere weeks before you're about to pop out your first baby. it's a lot of stop and start. But it was, I think it was a little bit linked in my mind, just thinking about kind of what would be the right thing for me to do as a mom, and knowing that my time was not going to be 24/7 dedicated to work anymore. And that was one of the reasons why, you know, media is so fast paced, as you know, it's so competitive. It's always on. So I was thinking that it would be good for me to do something where I could kind of use a different part of my brain and think about things that have really long-term impacts, and building companies doesn't happen overnight. It can take a decade. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of part of my thinking, but I probably also had some existential angst about the state of media as well, that I'd be happy to talk about maybe over a glass of wine.
Yeah. Get that insider track on what's going on in the big, big boy companies. And so,
anytime.
Yeah. And so with the, because as we talk about the companies that you and Alyssa and your firms are looking at investing in that can solve problems with our healthcare system. And, you know, I think sometimes this push and pull of which sector is the right sector to fix some of these big problems. And sometimes if you're in San Francisco, or if you're sometimes talking to a Republican, the idea is always it's going to be the private sector. And what have you seen or experienced, or I guess maybe just your opinion of like where that is true, and that the private sector can, and these growing companies and new innovative ideas can solve some of these bigger problems, versus where it ends up, it still needs to be policy and government.
It's a complicated question and complicated mix. You know, you could look at one example, which is 10 to 15 years ago, a lot of physicians in this country were still using paper-based systems to track their patients' medical information. It would be, you know, oftentimes they would like physically write things down. And that was how they would record your like, you know, all your complex medical notes. And so the government had to step in a big way. And this happened kind of right after the 2009, 2010 recession, where they basically said, we need to figure out a way to get doctors using electronic systems. And so they just incentivized them. They like, there was a massive pool of money, billions of dollars set aside for this. I think it was about $30 billion. And they got, you know, over 90% of doctors using electronic systems in quite a short period of time. So you could say, yay, big win for government. This is clearly better. Like we need to be kind of moving into the 21st century here. But there is also, you know, some downsides to that. And a lot of the problems are around the types of record keeping systems that these doctors migrated to were oftentimes the very outdated, very legacy technology systems that didn't allow for this information to be really easily shared. Mm-hmm. So then that kind of problem led to another whole huge set of problems where that information was essentially being locked up and medical mistakes were happening because you couldn't kind of easily share a patient's history between one health system and another. When you go to a different hospital, that information couldn't be easily shared. So, you know, that's just one example that I think, you know, tells a broader picture of what we often see in the healthcare space, that like well-meaning regulation can do a lot of good, but when you don't think it all the way through, and when you don't have the right incentives and the right rules in place, and sometimes you get these unintended consequences, and the private sector will kind of exploit that and take advantage of that for their own gain, but that may not be what's in the best interest of the patient.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. They are such big problems, and I think ultimately it probably is some kind of balance between the two of something that is more nimble versus something that has the power of at least, you know, the American government. But what kind of both as far as policy, but also your experience of you grew up in London, you're now married to an American, you live here, you've made most of your career here. And yet I feel like often I see some of your, both in your tweets, but also in your Substack, in the kind of like, what are we doing? And most recently, you were tweeted out that you were at a conference and said, "America to moms, you should breastfeed for 18 months to ensure the optimal health for your child. Also, America, please return to work in less than 2 weeks and pump milk in this supply closet." And like, what has that felt like in the comparison of what you know, how the UK approaches work-life balance for women versus what you're experiencing as a mom working in a, you know, big boy, like men, male dominated field of certain things that actually companies can't fix. And we just need our government to be smarter about. That's a leading question, but whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are only 5 countries in the world that don't have a federally mandated parental leave policy. And I believe it's us and like
Papua New Guinea
and some small island nations. So, you know, that's not a good look, on top of the fact that you just took away reproductive rights and there are massive infant formula shortages. Women are returning to work in this country in less than 2 weeks. It's shocking. And so I frankly just do not believe this country treats its women as well as other countries do. And I think it's a great travesty. And then you saw this data come out that the CDC put out a few weeks ago that the maternal mortality rate in the US is one of the highest in the developed, if not the highest of all developed countries. And 80% of those deaths are preventable.
Yeah.
So we're letting women die here in this country to have babies, and we're forcing them to have babies. And, you know, that it just gives me chills thinking about
and
this.
We're potentially on the verge of convicting doctors who are trying to help them have babies. We said this yesterday. In Wisconsin right now, there's 24 out of our 72 counties don't have an OBGYN.
And think about how much worse that's going to get over the next decade. And think about the lack of training opportunities for OBGYN residents in these states who will not get to see, you know, some of the necessary kind of abortion-related, miscarriage-related procedures that they need to be seeing in order to get, you know, proper medical training. So all of these things, I think, are really big problems. And I think we have a great healthcare system here for the rich. Hmm. And if you don't have money, like, it's just, you know, people are getting bankrupted. They don't get bankrupted in other countries. I'm sorry, I get very passionate about this. But,
no, I mean, that passion is good. Passion is good on the radio. It really brings it out. But no, I think a lot of people feel really passionately about this. And yet, and I think when talked about in a way of it doesn't have to be like this, it is a bipartisan where people actually, because it's like you said, it's bankrupting people and it's killing people. And the amount of avoidance of, well, I don't have insurance, so I'm going to avoid going to the doctor until I have a 10-pound tumor. you know, and these things that, like you said, if you have insurance, if you have an employer who provides good insurance, it doesn't, you know, maybe that's when the people who are holding on so tight to this private insurance game that almost everywhere else in the world doesn't do. And so have you done much besides your own experience of being from England? Have you done much of research either for companies or just out of your own curiosity of what could work here with so many people? I mean, while we're not nearly as big as China and India, we are the third most populous country in the world. And so sometimes I think people throw, oh, well, it wouldn't work here because we're so much bigger than any of these other European countries that have managed to figure it out, or any of the Japan or some of these other countries that have figured it out. Like, we have so many more people here. But as far as what could work and when it is actually politically feasible, is there any system that you think we could adopt?
Yeah.
To make things better?
I do. I mean, I think the Commonwealth Fund is a great resource for this, for those kind of looking to get educated. But, you know, America has this like weird Frankensteinian mix of both public and private sector in its healthcare system. We have government funded insurance. We have private insurance. We have so many different types of kind of payment and reimbursement. And it just doesn't make any sense. It's a complicated, intentionally complicated system. But I know that this is a country where, you know, probably having this be entirely a government-run system would be difficult for a lot of people to stomach. So then you can look at some of the rest of the world, and you could look at countries like Singapore. And what's entirely possible in these countries is to have universal healthcare. Everybody has access to some kind of basic kind of healthcare set of services, but it doesn't need to be government run. You could have it be some much more functioning combination of the two. Maybe it's you get some base level of care, and then everybody kind of pays into some kind of private system or a kind of a system that's run by more corporations, and therefore, you know, Republicans might find more palatable. And these models can work really well as well. You don't. It doesn't necessarily mean single payer. Just to say universal healthcare, they're not the same thing. So I think we might want to look at some of those countries if we think we could, you know, never really move towards a single payer system here.
That's interesting. So this isn't. I'm going to go totally different direction, but you know, producer Jane. Has worked in a male-dominated industry in radio. We talk a lot about how talk radio doesn't have a lot of women in it. When I worked in sales in tech companies, male-dominated. Even comedy, to a certain extent, male-dominated. You're now working in venture capital, which is also male-dominated. And you know, and even when we've had so many candidates come on in during this election cycle on the down ballot for our state legislature who are women, and the vitriol that I think happens for women leaders, whether they're founding companies or VC or politicians, is kind of universal across all of these. And so what has it been like making that transition? I mean, I don't know if media was much better anyways, but as far as your experience of navigating places with men, and not only just men, but men with big egos. Jane's smiling. You got 2 minutes. Another big question to round this out for.
Yeah. I mean, I've worked in male-dominated industries basically since college as well. I think we need to, you know, and this is something you and I should also get a glass of wine and talk about, but there's some ways in which it's the bias is obvious. Mm-hmm. And then some ways in which it's non-obvious. And I think when you've been in a sector for long enough, you can kind of think of examples of both, and it all adds up. And so I think, you know, it's like the text message group that Alyssa referenced that we have. I think women in this generation have started to come together and just form alliances in a way that we didn't 20 or 30 years ago, quite to the same extent. So there are more of us now, even though we are still in the minority. And I think we need to just be on each other's sides
root for each other and have these open and honest conversations about everything that we deal with, and how to get out the other side.
Absolutely. Well, I can't wait to see you in person because it feels like we have a lot to talk about that's not public. And so thank you so much for being here. Christina Farr is a former journalist and author of the Substack Second Opinion. You should absolutely subscribe to that, and a health tech investor at Omer's Ventures. Thank you so much for being here. I can't wait to have you back.
Thanks for having me. Me too.
All right. Well, we're going to take one more break and then wrap up today's show. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
The good old boys club, cigars and handshakes. I appreciate you, but no thanks. Another beer and a big machine.